listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Happy Friday. Bernie was with us yesterday, so we're going to have 3 hours of Anything Goes Friday. I want to start out, though, talking about white privilege. It's time for white America to understand, to get real about, to understand white privilege. For example, one of the largest, pastiest, whitest guys in America, Bill O'Reilly, came back from vacation early to host a special edition of his show over on Fox so-called News, The Factor, day before yesterday. And he said he was going to tell the truth about what's going on in Ferguson, Missouri. Right. O'Reilly went off on what he called race agitators, said they were using events in Ferguson to drive his word, agenda. Like, what's that agenda? He didn't say. And he really lost his cool after playing a clip of Michelle Bernard. Now, those of you who've been watching this program for a lot of years may remember Michelle Bernard used to be the president of the Independent Women's Forum. Carrie Lucas is on the show regularly. She's now, I believe, the president of it. And the Independent Women's Forum is a conservative think tank that speaks out. You know, and Michelle Bernard used to come on this program and debate with me. And then she started, you know, showing up on TV, and she got TV-ified, and now she doesn't do radio anymore. So she's a big deal in the TV world. And God bless her. She's really smart and very telegenic. But she started out as a conservative. She's an MSNBC commentator, but she's not a commentator because she is like Miss Liberal. Michelle Bernard has always been, very conservative. But on the issue, Michelle Bernard, by the way, is African-American. And on the issues of race, I don't think that there's a conservative or liberal position here. I think that there's a racist and a not racist position here, frankly. And unfortunately, a lot of white people, including Bill O'Reilly, are falling into that racist category. And I think in many cases, unconsciously, because they don't understand white privilege. First of all, to O'Reilly. Here is what O'Reilly said on his show day before yesterday.
Also on MSNBC, another agitator said this.
There is a war on black boys in this country. In my opinion, there is a war on African-American men. It is an absolutely deplorable situation that the United States, which is supposed to be the greatest nation on earth, sits back and allows black boys to be murdered.
Black boys being murdered in the context of Ferguson. Are you kidding me? The truth is that 91% of black homicide victims are killed by other blacks. 91%.
And that woman, about 90% of white victims are killed by other whites. I mean, what Bill O'Reilly did was two things. Number one, with that rant, he set up a straw man and then he knocked it over. But more importantly, number two is that clip of Michelle Bernard was edited by the producers over at Fox News, by Bill O'Reilly's people, to make it sound like she was saying something she didn't say. So, I mean, obviously black people aren't the only people getting killed by cops, and they're not the only race of people who experience police violence, and so it'd be ridiculous for Michelle Bernard to say what she said. But she wasn't just talking about cops killing young black men. Here is the full, unedited clip of what Michelle Bernard said, so that you can see that what Bill O'Reilly was doing was he was taking her comments, editing them to be something that they weren't, setting up a straw man that he could then knock down. Here's what Michelle Bernard actually said.
There is a war on black boys in this country. No. In my opinion, there is a war on African-American men. And I think the fact that President Obama has repeatedly had to stand up and look at members of Congress and say, I am the president of the United States, get over it. I think it enrages people. And we are seeing not just the economic effects, we're seeing the effects of a horrible public education system that discriminates against our kids on the basis of race and on the basis of their zip code. And things are getting much, much worse. It is an absolute deplorable situation that the United States, which is supposed to be the greatest nation on earth, sits back and allows black boys to be murdered.
So, get it? I mean, she was saying that here's this whole spectrum of issues that are impacting the African-American community. And in aggregate, this is the war on black boys and black men and black people. You know, there's a whole separate argument about the war on women, too, and it's of all colors, of all races. But clearly, what Bill O'Reilly doesn't get, and let's give him, I'm going to give him the credit, the benefit of the doubt here, and just say, I think that he doesn't get it. His producers don't get it. Pasty white guys who hang around with pasty white guys. Remember a couple of years ago, Bill O'Reilly went to Harlem, and he went to a restaurant. Up in Harlem, and a famous, very nice rest, in the middle of an African American, and he came back and he was on TV and he was going, whoa, they weren't yelling and they weren't throwing food and or whatever. I mean, words to that effect. He was just astounded by the fact that people sat and ate civilly and talked to each other appropriately and ordered from the menu, and it's like, wow. Black people have come a long way. I mean, and this is Bill O'Reilly's world, right? So let's give him the benefit of the doubt and assume that he and his producers are simply stupid and uninformed rather than, frankly, racist. But here's the bottom line. What Bill O'Reilly doesn't get, and what, frankly, most white people don't get, is that the shooting of Michael Brown and the killing by law enforcement of other young black men like him, like the one who was killed, the kid who was killed day before yesterday, don't happen in a vacuum. They happen in a country with a huge white privilege problem, and nobody's talking about this in the media. No discussion of white privilege in the media. And there should be. There's a lot of different ways to define white privilege, but at its core, you could call it a system of social relations. It gives white people an inborn advantage over people of other races just because of the color of their skin. It's like white supremacy and apartheid because it puts white people at the top of society. They can explicitly use Jim Crow laws to oppress people who aren't white, or now the modern version of them, the voter suppression laws that just passed North Carolina, for example, by the white legislature. What really makes white privilege so problematic, though, is that most white people don't understand it. That's the single biggest part of white privilege. That's the biggest part of white privilege, is that white people are privileged to not realize that they have white privilege. They never have to worry about the fact that they're white. Peggy McIntosh, feminist scholar, said, white privilege is like an invisible, weightless knapsack of special provisions, maps, passports, code books, visas, tools, clothes, and blank checks. And because white people are born carrying that invisible knapsack, they don't even usually know that they have it. Here's white privilege. White people don't have to worry about getting pulled over on the highway because of the color of their skin. It doesn't even occur to them. We don't worry about getting denied a mortgage because of the color of our skin. For the most part, don't think about people crossing the street to avoid us. Richard Pryor said he finally understood what it was like to be white in America when he went to black Zimbabwe. And he said, I really now know how white people feel in America. Relaxed, because when I hear a police siren in Zimbabwe, I know they're not coming after me. Right. The flip side of white privilege is the presumption of criminality of black people. White people never worry about being treated like bad guys. African Americans almost always have to worry about being treated like bad guys. Back with more of it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
If you have stories, by the way, if you're African-American, of being discriminated against, if you're white, of coming to an understanding about white privilege or any of this aspect of this, give us a shout. The By the way, just kind of bad news on the bad news front. Well, actually, Jared in Burlington, Vermont is on the line watching Free Speech TV on the cable system there in Burlington. Hey, Jared, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you? Again, I'm not going to talk about what I've talked about before, the Shafta, but it's related to it. Okay. I'd like to talk about spending priority by the U.S. government.
All right.
Specifically, the F-35. 14 years ago, Congress set aside $400 billion for the development. It presently costs about $200 million a copy for a battle ready, and also given the various things that one has, mechanics and stuff, it's an expensive thing.
And it doesn't work.
Putting it in focus, the health center in Burlington, Vermont, cost $1 billion, or excuse me, $1 million.
Right.
$1 million.
Right. You could have created 400 of those health centers for one F-35.
Exactly. And they want to build what?
I don't know. I don't know the numbers, but I do know that what the contractor did was they made sure that there was construction of the F-35 was done in every congressional district in the United States.
That's right. Right. You know, sometimes they have do the left wing. Sometimes they do a wheel. Vermont does, I guess, the engines or part
of
the engines.
Yeah. Well, this is an example of the contractors being really, really smart. I mean, you know, there's 6,000 jobs in Vermont that depend on the F-35. And so, you know, people like Bernie find themselves in a really difficult position of, okay, do I go against stupid defense spending or do I go against 6,000 jobs in my own state? And you know, at the end of the day, an elected official always has to represent their own state first, unless it's a, you know, just a major moral issue, like does the country go to war? And so, I get the conflict of that. But what, you know, what's, do you have a, are you calling to propose a solution or?
No, I thought that Bernie was going to be on this afternoon. But anyway.
Yeah. He's on tomorrow. He was on yesterday, excuse me.
Okay.
He's at Jim Jeffords' funeral right now. That's why he's not on.
Right.
You know, Jim Jeffords.
I can understand Senator Leahy supporting the F-35, and I can understand Representative Welch supporting the F-35, but I can't understand Bernie supporting his support of the F-35.
6,000 jobs is 6,000 jobs in a small state, and they're good jobs.
Good jobs and the 6,000 votes.
Well, I'm not. You know, that's a fairly cynical analysis of it.
I am cynical.
Yeah, no, I understand. And I think, first of all, it's arguably far more than 6,000 votes, because all those 6,000 workers, probably the majority of them have spouses who are voters. Many of them have kids who are voters. They have neighbors and family who are voters. They have communities that are supported by their paychecks who are voters. So it's probably more like 40, 50,000 voters. And that's a big chunk of voters in a state with only, you know, what, 300,000 voters in it? So it's a big deal. Jared, I don't have an answer for you other than getting money out of politics. I think, you know, Bernie's efforts to roll back Citizens United so the defense contractors can no longer basically bribe members of Congress would go a long way toward doing away with things like the F-35. Thanks for the call, Jared. We'll be back. Back, Tom Hartman. Okay, let me just finish this this riff, Danielle, that I was sort of in the middle of about white privilege. That white privilege is because the essence of white privilege is not having to even think about white privilege. You know, people of color get this; white people don't. And this is why the killing of Michael Brown has struck such a nerve with people of color all across the country. It's brought home, and it's why I think the opinion polls are showing that only about 35% of white Americans think that the shooting of Michael Brown is an indication of a racial problem in this country, whereas about 80% of African Americans say, yeah, of course. This has brought home in a very brutal and very personal way the fears of people of color in this country, the fears that they live with every day. You know, every mother whose son goes off to school every day, will I see him alive at the end of the night? I mean, the most powerful of those fears in communities of color in this country, particularly poor communities of color, is that the cops won't hesitate to kill you if they get a chance. That fear is justified. The FBI's own statistics show that black people are disproportionately victims of police shootings. African Americans make up 12% of our population, 31% of all the victims of police shootings. And when you look at police shootings where the victims were not attacking anybody when they were killed, 39% of them are African Americans, police shootings. We live in a society where white privilege infects every relationship, every institution, every decision we make. And which is why the shooting of an unarmed young black man by a white police officer doesn't just happen. It doesn't happen in a vacuum. It's tied into this bigger issue of a racial power structure that continues to control this country 149 years after the abolition of slavery. So instead of blithering about racial agitators and lecturing black Americans about smoking pot, Bill O'Reilly and other white Americans like him should take a good long look at this racial power structure and understand how we, speaking as a white guy, how we benefit from it. And then, you know, we can say, okay, now, so what do we do about making sure that everybody has that same opportunity? An equal society is not going to happen overnight. But the only way that we're going to move forward, particularly given that moving forward is something that is largely in the hands of white people in this country, as the numeric majority, as the power majority, as the financial majority, white Americans have to realize how much they continue to profit from racism, both past and present. How much white people need to understand how much they benefit from white privilege. It's time for white Americans to get real about white privilege. Anyhow, let's pick up some of your calls on this. And anything else you want to talk about. It's anything goes, you know, summer, so, and it's Friday on top of that. But this is something I think, you know, because I'm not hearing a word about this on any of the television networks. The right-wing commentators are certainly not talking about it. It seems really important that somebody do so, and so here I am. Dan in Great Lakes, Illinois. Hey, Dan, thanks for listening to WCPT. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Once again, God bless you for the work that you do.
Thank you.
I am a 50-year-old African-American male. I always start out by saying that. Tom, I work on a naval installation. This is federal property where I work. My boss is under 40 years of age, served 5 years in the Illinois Department of Corrections. He is a white male. African-American young men, when they show up for a job, they have the wrong paint job, the wrong color to start with. And these young men who live in these communities, once they get arrested, you add an arrest record to their paint job, and their lives are ruined forever for smoking marijuana.
Right. Or for talking back to a cop or whatever they get arrested for, or for driving while black.
Absolutely right. And I said that to say that my boss is a white male under 40 years of age, who was able to get a job as a supervisor on a federal installation working for we are paid through appropriated funds. He is getting paid through taxpayer dollars and on a 12-year sentence served 5 years.
So you've got a white guy who has a prison record. And black people with a prison record would not even have a chance of being hired, but this white guy with a prison record is the boss? Is that what you're saying?
That is what I am telling you.
Wow.
He is my boss. So when we say white privilege, this is what we talk about all the time.
Yep.
That's what I have to say.
Dan, would you agree with my assertion that the vast majority of probably all African Americans understand white privilege, and the vast majority of white people don't have a clue what I'm talking about?
Tom, they cannot, because the country, it's a birth defect. It started out the wrong way.
Yeah.
It's congenital.
Well, it's sort of like fish don't notice the water they're swimming through.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, Dan, we're hitting the break here. So thank you for your call, and thanks for sharing your story with us. Great to hear from you. We will be back with more right after this. It's 28 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. It's Anything Goes Friday, Anything Goes Summer. But I really would like to have a conversation with you about white privilege in the United States and what it means and what we do about it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And check out our brand new, newly redesigned website at TomHartman.com and our new video over at GreenWorldRising.org. Very mordivorously ugly, the good. The Advertising Standards Authority, the United Kingdom's advertising regulator, has taken a big step toward exposing the lies of the fossil fuel industry. It's banned Peabody Energy from using the words clean coal to make it seem like coal is a zero emissions energy source. The move came after the World Wildlife Federation complained that some Peabody Energy ads implied that coal was actually clean. Well, the fact is that there's no such thing as clean coal. Good on the ESA for sticking up for the truth. Let's hope this starts a serious discussion, both in the UK and here in the US, about the real meaning of clean energy. The bad. Mike Ditka. During a recent interview with a sports journalist who runs a website devoted to Washington's NFL team, the legendary Chicago Bears coach said that the team should keep its controversial nickname because it's meant out of reverence to the American Indian.
What's all the stink over the Redskin name? It's so much. It's incredible. We're going to let the liberals of the world run this world. It was set out of reverence, out of pride to the American Indian. Even though it was called a Redskin, what are you going to call them? A brownskin? This is so stupid, it's appalling. And I hope that order keeps fighting for it and never changes it, because the Redskins are part of American football history and it should never be anything but the Washington Redskins. That's the way it is.
Sorry, Mark, there's nothing reverential about a racial slur. Changing the name of Washington's NFL team isn't some liberal conspiracy. It's just the decent thing to do. And the very, very ugly, Brian Fisher. During his radio show this week, the American Family Association member responded to the killing of journalist James Foley by ISIS militants by saying that Islam was like the Ebola virus and needed to be quarantined. All of Islam, not ISIS. All of Islam. Seriously, check it out.
Islam is like the Ebola virus. It's deadly. It's lethal. And all you can do with a virus like that, there's no cure for it. It can only be contained. It has to be stopped. And the way you do it is through quarantine. You got to quarantine it. You got to contain it. And I'm suggesting that's really all we can do with this pure, unvarnished Islam, is all we can do is contain it. Like we do the Ebola virus. You know, there are a lot of countries now that will not accept any immigrants from the African countries where the Ebola virus has broken out. I'm suggesting we got to do the same thing with Islam.
It's not only extremely bigoted, it's a huge insult to all the Muslims in Iraq and Syria right now who are dying at the hands of ISIS. It's very, very ugly. So, that said, Jerry in New York City. Hey, Jerry, what's up? Jerry, I can't hear you. Your phone is really, really muffled. Is it possible you have your thumb over the microphone or something like that?
No.
Or I'm on a speakerphone? Okay, Jerry, I'm going to put you on hold, and you and Danielle can work that out. And maybe we can. Jerry's on line three, Danielle. John in Elgin, Illinois. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. This is a follow-up on the person that called in yesterday. I think a former police officer in West Virginia.
Yeah.
And the matter of, and also there was somebody else who had maybe the same person, had a daughter who is a clinical psychologist who's working with the screening
yeah.
police candidates. Am I correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I was a civil rights worker in Mississippi in 1964. And Bob Moses is, I consider, one of the greatest and probably most low-key leaders in this country, in the history of the country. But one of the things that they did, and this is kind of the reverse of the problems with our law enforcement. One of the things they did when they were recruiting volunteers was they asked questions to screen out people with the John Brown complex.
Which is?
They saw themselves on a mission to, you know, free these darkies in Mississippi. And I think, I'm afraid that we're not doing a very good job of screening people who want to go into law enforcement.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think that one of the reasons that we don't screen them all that well is because the pool of candidates is not as broad as it could be or should be. And I think the pool of candidates isn't as broad as it could or should be because we don't pay them well enough.
Exactly. And that was a brilliant thing about, I think, your comment about Sweden. And that is makes so much sense. But, you know, it hurts the people to have the money.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
They think it does.
Yeah, I'm with you. John, thanks a lot for the call. Well said. Jerry in New York. You want to try it again?
Yes, I can. Thank you, Tom. Pleasure speaking to you.
Thank you.
I'm an African-American, 60 years old, very diverse background, retired educator, and also been an entrepreneur. My father worked with Dr. King. Just want to say I think if more of my white brothers knew African-American history, knew the role of what we played in creating this country, even with what is currently going on in Ferguson, they would know our relationship with the police historically. They would know that what we're seeing with ISIS, black people feared in this country, not for 50 years or 100 years, but for 200 and 300 years, being hung, being lynched, being castrated, children taken away, never to be seen again. These are things that we experienced in this country for hundreds of years. So sometimes when they see our reaction, that's why they can't understand it, because our experience and the American experience is different from everybody else. And if they knew our history, our contributions to this country, all the things that we have done, the Bill O'Reillys of the world wouldn't chastise Detroit, because there was a time in Detroit where you can graduate from high school, and in 2 or 3 years, you'd have a home, you'd have a car, you could take care of your family. Those days are gone, and that's why African Americans, young people in that city, are suffering.
Right.
90% of youth in the city of Chicago under age 21, 90% are unemployed. So what do you think people are going to do? I'm not making excuses, but people just don't understand the circumstances.
I agree. And this is again, this gets back to this issue of white privilege, where white people don't, you know, by and large. I mean, I was in West Virginia three or four weeks ago. We spent the weekend there. And you know, there are some really deep pockets of white poverty in West Virginia. But those are the exception rather than the rule, I would say. But the history is still with us. People say, you know, Bill O'Reilly's response to you would be, yeah, that was 100 years ago. That's not happening today. Get over it, basically, would be what he would say. But the reality is that at a much more subtle level, it's still happening today. And that's what we need to address. And not just what's happening to African Americans, but how the role that white people play in that, even when they just think that they're just, you know, hey, I'm just fine. I'm not doing any of that kind of stuff. No, but if you're white, you're benefiting from just being born white. And
as an educator, I mean, things like here in New York where we had stop and frisk, where over the years of the Bloomberg administration, who's supposed to be a liberal mayor, every black youth in the city was stopped, thrown up against the wall. If they had marijuana in their pocket, they were arrested. Now they have a record. I had many students that had those issues, and people don't realize that, as your other caller said, that impacts the rest of their life.
Yes.
And you can go on any college campus today and go to the dorm, and white kids have marijuana. Harlem is now an integrated community. It's gentrified. I can walk in Harlem where I used to live in blocks that weren't safe, and whites are out on the weekend drinking wine on their stoop, smoking marijuana. The police don't bother them.
Right.
But yet we knew up until a few years ago, or up until last year, blacks could be walking down the street in this city and empty your pockets, get up against the wall. This was something I would see at least every other day.
Yeah.
And once again, these are things that my white brothers, I wish they understood.
Yeah, I'm with you. Jerry, very well said. Thank you very much for the call. Donald in Menlo Park, California. You wanted to share a story?
Yes. I get off the train station at Menlo Park, coming from San Francisco, and there's a caravan of lunch trucks, and I in line, and out of all the people that are gathered around these lunch trucks, two men in blue come up to me and introduce themselves, and they're police officers. And even pretending to be nice, I'm forced to talk to them, shake their hands, and the final question comes out, do you live around here? And remembering an earlier experience when I lived in Los Angeles on Nichols Canyon Boulevard, where I had a cottage.
If I can stop you, Donald, you're black? You're African-American?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
I was in my backyard, and I come into my house, do a few things. It's late. I go to bed, and I see lights flashing in the front of the cottage. I look out, and I see it's police officers. Well, I realize that I haven't called them. Nothing's going on, so I decide just to go back to bed. Through the French doors, I hear the doors being broken open in the front of the cottage. Suddenly, there are several police officers in my cottage. Well, I know who's entered, but I pretend that it's my housemaid, and I call out, Ed, is that you? They come up. I'm in my underwear. I come out into the hallway. They have guns on me. I tell them that I live here. I have to tell them where my wallet is in my bedroom so they can go get it and get my ID.
Amazing. Because a neighbor called because they saw a black person walking into that house.
Two white gay guys that had just moved into a cottage behind me.
Oh, man. Donald, thank you for the call. Thanks for sharing your story.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
This is white privilege at work. This is the reality of race in America. We'll be back. And welcome back. Bill, watching Free Speech TV in Dayton, Ohio. Hey, Bill, you're on the air.
Hi. Good to hear you.
Thank
We've
you.
Been watching and listening to you for a good bit, and I must say I do enjoy every point of view that I've heard come out of your mouth.
Well, thank you,
Bill. We both appreciate your show and all the other shows we watch on your network. I wanted to express a little bit about my upbringing. I'm a young, I'm an old young white man from Ohio, Ohio, and when I was young, my parents taught us a lot about diversity. My father's a pastor. But he also worked for NCR, and I was grown up with union workers. I've grown up with Caucasian community churches, and I grew up with a separated ethnic European neighborhood that was really, if you was in the wrong block in the neighborhood, the kids would beat you up because you were not the right Catholic, you weren't the right German, you weren't the right Irish, you weren't the right... I won't say the word.
Yeah, and you're a white guy.
Yeah, okay.
And you're a white guy? Bill?
I'm Caucasian, yes.
You're Caucasian, okay. Go for it.
Yep. As my parents helped enlighten me through my young ages and my teenage years, I had encountered seeing a lot of things in my life, and I can make it short and sweet, trying to bring it up to today. High school, Kaiser, my high school, they started the busing. And I was amazed. And at the same time, the counselors came forward a week after we all had our little big boy fight in school. And most of the guys didn't say anything, but the counselors were like trying to tell us how to get along. And I stood up and I pointed out that they're a little late, just like anybody at school, like a bully. I have watched all my neighbors fight each other for 20 years. And in 1 week, all the ethnic guys from Europe actually worked together to fight against the new black guys that came into our classrooms.
Right. So
I thought it was the most ridiculous thing I ever saw in my life.
Right.
And I called him on it. And the counselor was like looking at me strange. And I said, well, that was just that. So at that young age, I was a little bit younger. I was with a family and we was going up to Dearborn, Michigan and Detroit to the Henry Ford Museum. And I had no idea at the time why these firemen lose in this dirty bus with loads of white people. And I looked at my dad. I said, Daddy,
Why is the fireman water hosing those people and rolling them like balls down the street? Why is he doing that to them? And my dad just kind of looked at me and said, sit down and be quiet. And all I can remember was that bus was snow quiet the rest of the trip through deep territory, going past the GM and everything. The speaker guy that was standing up front sat down. Now the word was said the rest of the way because this little boy said something.
Yeah.
Well, my father taught me to understand all kinds of religions, all kinds of people, ethnic, color, what do you like to
say? You know, you raise a really interesting point, Bill, is that there are still neighborhoods in America today where white people are fighting against each other because, you know, they're Catholic or Protestant, or they're Italian, or they're Polish or Sicilian or Irish or whatever. But at the end of the day, they can always assimilate into the broader white society and basically stop identifying as an ethnic minority and start identifying as part of the majority. Black people can't do that. And that's something that white people need to understand. Bill, thanks for the call. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where we dare to ask is Walmart or Hobby Lobby a person, and we dare to say no. Don't care what Scalia says, they're not. Shane in Houston, Texas. Hey, Shane, what's on your mind today?
Howdy. Thomas, I'm a first-time listener, and I commend you for raising this issue about the white privilege, because I think it needs to be addressed, and I'm going to try to keep this short and sweet. Of course, black male from the Houston area. I work for a major oil and gas company. I'm the only African-American male in the group. And a little bit of my background, I have a dual master's in engineering from a major university. So long story short, I believe that my performance is spectacular at the company. I did a lot at the company. And for some reason, during my mid-year and final year reviews, my boss, which is a white female, early 40s, my reviews are plagued with, hey, you came in 5 minutes late. You say, okay, let's talk about performance. We could talk about performance. But, you know, I was behind your back looking at you on the internet. Or, you know, you left 2 minutes late. Why did you come in late yesterday? I said, well, I took my wife to have a medical procedure. Oh, that's nice. Well, then I asked her, well, why did the other young lady come in late, which is a white female? She said, well, she has dogs. She has a border dog. So, you know, I'm in a situation where I have to come in 20 minutes early. We're salary, so we're not punching in on the clock. 20 minutes early, leave 30 minutes late. I've been, you know, addressed on how I dress, websites I visit, time I come in. I mean, the list goes on, none of which has anything to do with performance. Right. And performance gets avoided. And it's now affecting my career because I can't apply for any other jobs, any promotions, or anything else because of these little dings on my job performance. So right. I'm starting to realize that it doesn't have anything to do with my performance or it has mostly to do with, you know, you talked about that locking the door when you see a minority. It's that subconscious, you know, racism type of thing going on. And I think that I'm being effective with this. I've worked for several major companies, IT, tech, aerospace, and I'm usually the only black guy that's in the group. And I'm experiencing this with every job that I've had. And that's all I wanted to say. It just
you said it very well. And Joe Madison on this show a couple days ago, or maybe it was the end of last week. I forget when Joe was on, but I think it was just a few days ago. He said, Joe is African-American, and he said, I told my son, you have to be twice as good as your white peers because, you know, you've just got it, you know, because of the whole white privilege problem. You're going to be judged more harshly than white people would be. And you're, Shane, you're corroborating that. And odds are that this woman is, she's not doing it maliciously. She's unaware that she's cutting. What she's doing is that she's cutting slack for the white people and not for you, as opposed to jumping on you and not the white people. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. And, you know, and funny part is, you know, with all the degrees, with all the experience that I have 15 years experience in engineering. I am the lowest paid person on the pay scale in the group.
Wow.
I came into the company at a lower pay scale. And, you know, I found that out because, you know, we have job grades there and everyone assumed that I was a job grade, whatever. And I'm like, no, I'm way below that. So my pay is even,
is affected by your race.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazing.
Right. Thank you.
Shane,
thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks for sharing your story. Trevor in Belize. Belize? South America?
Yes, that is correct.
Or Central America? Which is it?
Yes, it is Central America.
Central America. Thank you.
Yeah, just near Mexico and Guatemala, southern Mexico and.
Yeah, I've been. I was there once, but I was there on a cruise ship, and I don't remember where it was.
That's right. I was actually in the UK when you took that cruise. I heard you talk about that.
Okay.
Tom, something about Bill O'Reilly's rant, and I've heard a lot of people say this. They keep pointing out as if there's some significance to the statistics that there are more African-American males murdered or killed by other African-American males than they are killed by police. Now, while that might be true, they fail to realize the stupidity of the comparison. African-American males who kill other African-American males by, shall we say, by definition, are unsavory characters. They are lawless people. On the other hand, the job of the police technically is supposed to be to protect you, not to kill you.
Right.
Therefore, to compare a lawless person who kills somebody with the person who is supposed to be at the pinnacle, shall we say, of the standard is ludicrous.
Yeah. Well, and not only that, the majority of white people are killed by white people and not by police, too.
Well,
so
this is true. And
it's a straw man.
The black man is worse than between the rock and the hard, because if you assume that he's running from another black man who is trying to kill him, and he runs towards a white police officer for safety, the white police officer would probably shoot him, seeing that black as a threat. So he will be shot anyway.
Right.
It's crazy.
Yeah, I agree. This and the piece of this, you know, I think that most white people get overt, explicit, racist, good old-fashioned George Wallace discrimination. What they don't get is that they were born with white privilege, that if a white person was fleeing somebody who was trying to kill him and ran toward a white cop, he would probably not be shot. A black person fleeing a crime, not a criminal, a person fleeing to avoid being the victim of a crime, running into a cop, may well be shot. And just because the color of his skin changes the presumption. If the color of the skin is white, there's the presumption that he's innocent. If the color of the skin is black, there's the presumption that he's guilty. And that's not how it should be in this country. Trevor, thank you for the call. It seems to me that the solution to this is to go back to what Lyndon Johnson started with affirmative action programs and level the playing field right across the board. Give people bootstraps to pull themselves up by. We'll be back.
Listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show. So please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. In the lighter news for the day, this is amazing. You know, the Westboro Baptist Church, Fred Phelps has now gone past ways. He's gone into the light. But and hopefully it was a joyous and enlightening experience for him. I personally believe that's, you know, what we all experience when our bodies stop working, shall we say, when we die. But his church lives on, and they've gone from just saying that God hates gay people to now saying that God hates Islam. There's a nice picture over at addictinginfo.org of the Westboro Baptist Church holding signs that say God hates Islam, Muslims die, God laughs, repent or perish, imams rape, you know, all this kind of stuff. And so when the Westboro Baptist Church said that they were going to go out and pick at Robert Williams' funeral because he supported gay people, or maybe because he was Jewish. I don't know exactly what the basis of their picket was going to be. This comedian, I believe he's a British comedian, Adam Hills, said publicly, if these guys want to go to Iraq and protest, I will pay their way. And they have said, okay, cool, we'll go. So they're going to go to Iraq and protest ISIS, right? God hates Muslims. To the people who are beheading Christians. This could get interesting. I'll just leave it at that. It could get interesting. Meanwhile, President Obama, after he... I think I left that out in the other room. President Obama, after he gave the announcement that this photographer had been beheaded, went and played golf. And the right-wingosphere is hysterical about it. Of course, they're hysterical about any time the President Obama plays golf, and have been for years. For example, back in 2009, when the swine flu scare was going on, Fox News got hysterical that he was playing golf. So no more golfing during hyped-up viral outbreaks. He played golf 10 times in a 10-week span, and so Fox News called him the first duffer. Right, no golfing 10 weeks in a row. When the Icelandic volcano erupted in 2010, that was 2009, and it prevented him from going to Poland to attend the Polish president's funeral, he played golf. The Washington Times attacked him for that. No playing golf when you should be at a funeral. He went golfing while oil was still leaking into the Gulf of Mexico from the BP rig. Chairman Michael Steele of the RNC demanded that he stop playing golf until the oil leak stops. No golfing during oil spills. This, by the way, from the Daily Banter, Michael Luciano, thedailybanter.com. That was 2010. 2011, Obama goes golfing while the price of oil increases. Oh, my God. And he says, by oil, I mean that good old West Texas intermediate crude. No, that's just a European Brent crude stuff. March 16th, Obama goes golfing as the Fukushima nuclear plant continues to leak radioactive material. No golfing during nuclear meltdowns anywhere in the world. May 1st, Obama plays 9 holes and finishes several hours before the start of the Navy SEAL mission that would kill Osama bin Laden. He was attacked by Town Hall, Newsmax, InfoWars. They reported that he was golfing a mere 20 minutes before the raid. Not true. Apparently no golfing if you've got a special ops mission coming up in the next 24 hours. On May 30th, Fox News noted that Obama went golfing on Memorial Day. Oh, my God. Can't do that. No golfing on Memorial Day. Kevin McCarthy says that he's now the House whip, the House Majority Whip, number two guy in the House. Replaced Eric Cantor. Kevin McCarthy, who was there for the caucus room conspiracy, he says Obama should stop golfing while debt ceiling negotiations are ongoing, according to Michael Luciano over at the Daily Banter. So no golfing when Republicans are threatening to shut down the government. There was a 5.8 earthquake that hit Washington, D.C. when Obama was playing golf at Martha's Vineyard. Apparently, he can't do that. If an earthquake is going to happen anywhere, and he just goes on and on. I mean, there's like, you know, four pages of this, of times that Republicans have attacked Obama for playing golf. At this point in his presidency, George Bush had taken over 400 vacation days. Obama has taken a little over 100. Ronald Reagan slept through almost every day. Which gets back to my topic of white privilege. I don't recall white presidents being attacked for golfing, and golfing has been historically such a white sport that just in the last few years have some of the largest golf courses in America integrated, allowed black members. So is the subtext here, and again, maybe these white commentators don't even realize it, that their real subtext is, what's this black guy playing golf for? I mean, when Jerry Ford did it, when George W. Bush, well, George W. Bush didn't so much play golf. He didn't play golf so often. He'd go running, he'd do his bike, but, you know, whatever. When they take time off, it's like, oh, isn't that nice? He looks presidential. But a black guy on the golf course? Nah, he doesn't look presidential. I maybe I'm reading more into it than is there, but somehow I don't think so. Gary in Santa Ana, California. Hey, Gary, welcome to the program.
Afternoon, Tom. Let me put my pipe down here and tell you that I am a white, half white, half Japanese, look Hawaiian kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
My wife is all Japanese. And this happened about 5 years ago. I was at a Mervyn store in Orange County, California, Irvine. And there was this white woman and her 16-year-old daughter at the counter, and she was being helped by a black young salesman. And I simply walked up to the counter and was told by the black salesman that he would help me. And before he could finish his thought, the white lady freaks out and says, "Oh, that's how you people act like, you know." And I said, "Oh, no, you didn't say that." And, my, you know, I mean, here we are in, you know, 2010, 2009. And, I mean, you know, my wife didn't understand the gist of it, but, you know, she didn't understand why I was getting upset. And the child was, you know, kind of distraught looking away, embarrassed for the situation. So I didn't know what she was feeling. But, you know, I mean, here I was being put into the situation. I could not say nothing, though. I had to speak up about this.
Right.
And, you know, my parents, my father who grew up like that one other gentleman earlier, you know, said, you know, with good thoughts and good training, but still not understanding white privilege. And telling his son, you know, why are they, you know, rolling down the black people like balls, you know, I mean, and the father had nothing to say about it. My father was the same way. You know, he was white. He was the white Pollock. That's what he called himself, and he said, you know, oh, there's Jerry the Cat, you know, and that was the black guy at the college that my father worked at. There was this black guy, and he called him Jerry the Cat because there was, you know, the cat, you know, it was derogatory. He meant it in a specious way, you know, I mean, without even understanding what he was saying. And
right.
My father, you know, grew up in that time, but I just wanted to thank you for your bringing this wonderful topic up. I mean, it's wonderful in the fact that it's so edifying and horrifying in the same way.
Yeah, we need to be talking about it. This. Thank you, Gary. I agree. This issue of white privilege is, I don't know why it is never discussed in the mainstream media. It's the one thing nobody wants to acknowledge. Gary, thank you for the call. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's Anything Goes, Friday, summer, you name it. We'll be back with more of your questions. Welcome back. Cliff in Canyon Country, California, watching on Free Speech TV. Hey, Cliff, what's up?
Dr. Tom, I've been calling you for years, but I never told you how much I respect and honor your tolerance and your patience, especially with some of your guests on The Lone Liberal Rebel on your Big Picture show. I could never be so tolerant and patient. That's really, really good on you.
Thank you.
Set a really good example for the rest of us.
Thank you.
Hey, Yeah. Back in the 70s on Saturday Night Live, Eddie Murphy did this skit where they dressed him up like a white guy with makeup and the clothes and everything, and they followed him around town documenting white privilege. Like, he would go, the one, I don't remember all the instances, but the one I really remember is he went into a bank for a loan, and he brings him into the back room, and the guy just slides him a bag of money, you know, wink, wink, laugh, laugh, you know, you're a white guy here. Here's free money.
Right.
And
do you remember what happened when he got on the bus in that skit? Tell me if I'm remembering this right. He gets on this
bus.
He gets on this bus, and it's filled with white people, and they're partying and having champagne, and they got half, you know, scantily clad ladies, and everybody's just, you know, boogieing. And then the bus stops, and a black guy gets on, and all of a sudden everybody goes silent and just sits there, like nothing's going on. And then the black guy gets off, and everybody goes back to partying and having a good old time.
They all start partying.
Maybe that was a separate skit, but yeah.
No, that probably was the same skit, because I think it was like a 5-minute long skit. It was a pretty long one for Saturday Night Live, and
yeah.
I think it was called White Like Me.
Yeah.
And for people that are a lot younger than us, they could probably go watch it on YouTube to this day. It was really, really...
It was hysterical.
It was funny, but it was hysterical, but it was also... Right.
Sobering.
On point.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It was an excellent, excellent skit, so... Any of your listeners want to, you know, check that out? I think it's still available.
Cool. Cliff, thanks for the memory hole reminder there. I appreciate it. That Eddie Murphy skit was brilliant. Jim in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida, watching Free Speech TV. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'm breaking up a little bit. Am I coming through clear?
So far.
Okay. I just remembered a couple of things. Back in the 70s, when I was in college studying on the racial inequalities in the judicial system, okay, and that the numbers that they were saying of how many black men were in through or going through the judicial system back then, and I recently looked at those numbers again, up-to-date numbers, and to me, and I didn't verify this completely, but I know I verified them in the 70s, are virtually the same. This is kind of alarming, okay? Now, I studied the racial judicial system back in the 70s when I was in college. And when I did, and I studied that part, too, about the privatization of the prison systems in the South for the 70s.
I would assert it's gotten a lot worse since the 70s. If you look at the incarceration rates for African Americans, they're much higher now than they were in the early 70s. I mean, Nixon's drug war is what kicked it off in 72.
Well, I would agree that if you take away the drug laws, you probably would eliminate that inequality.
Yeah, or at least a good chunk of it. There are other factors, but yeah. Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Good point. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Harbin here with you. We had there's a couple of other things I wanted to talk with you about. This I think is really, and I want to show this story, and then I'll pick up your phone calls here. Back in the 60s, and in fact I've got this story somewhere in my stack here. Back in the 60s, it was the Black Panthers. They started listening to, and California had an open carry, it was an open carry state. You could walk around anywhere in California with a gun on your hip, and or pretty much anywhere in California. I don't know if there were some municipalities that didn't allow that, but and so what happened was that. Okay, it's not in that stack. Anyway, I'll just tell you the story. I don't need to find the actual details. You can track it down yourself quite easily. So sometime in the 60s, what happened was that the Black Panthers would show up with their guns showing when they heard on the police scanner that an African-American was being stopped or was being tracked or whatever. And this got into the news, Californians freaked out. Some guy, some politician, I think his name was Mulland or something like that. He proposed a gun control law that ended open carry in California because of the Black Panthers. Right? It was fine with California for 150 years when white people were doing open carry. But the minute that the Black Panthers showed up with a gun strapped to their hip, it was, oh, my God. You know, shades of Blazing Saddles. And so they literally passed a gun control law to stop the Black Panthers from carrying guns to crime scenes where white police were confronting black citizens. So now down in Dallas, which, you know, Texas is an open carry state. And in Dallas, you can walk around with a gun on your hip. So they've formed this, a group of African Americans have formed a gun club. They call it the Huey P. Newton Gun Club. Huey Newton, one of the founders of the Black Panthers, if my memory serves me right. And they're showing up at police stops. According to the gun club's website, quote, the police have murdered over 70 unarmed individuals, most of them black and brown men, over the last 10 years. Excluding a recent incident where police testimony was contradicted by surveillance footage, there have been no indictments since 1973. Thus, they formed the Huey Newton Gun Club, named after the co-founder of the Black Panthers, quote, for the specific purpose of self-defense and community policing. And here's a picture of two black guys dressed up like the white guys at the Bundy Ranch, you know, with an AR-15 over their shoulder and ammunition belts and, you know, the whole thing. And I say, good on you guys. And let's see how long it takes before Texas does away with open carry. You want gun control? And this gets back to white privilege. You want gun control in a state that has open carry laws? The legislature, the white legislature will be just fine with open carry laws as long as it's mostly white people who are showing up at these gun rallies. But when black people start showing up at these gun rallies or start forming their own, woo-hoo, things will change fast. Charles in Evanston, Illinois. Hey, Charles, welcome to the program.
Thank you for allowing me to speak to you, Tom.
Sure.
I just wanted to premise this first of all by saying that I'm a professional, and my cousin who was with me is also a professional. He received a couple of tickets to go to a Cubs game from his job. He works in IT. And we just got off the train, going to a Cubs game, and all of a sudden, these two police officers approached us and slammed us against a wall and started searching us.
Really?
And next thing I know, they put us in the back of the back seat of the car, of the police car, squad car, and drove off with us. And they said that we fit this description of somebody who stole a purse or something like this. But well, we had our IDs on them, but I showed them this was our ID. We actually live in Evanston, and, you know, we're just going to a Cubs game. Here are the tickets we had and everything like that. And you know what the cop said to us? He said, well, you probably did something anyway.
Wow. Because you're black.
And then he drove, and then like a mile away, he dropped us off. He said he got a call. He goes, and the quote from the cop was like, oh, you guys are lucky today. He got a call to go something, some emergency, something else, and he just dropped us off a mile away, and we had to walk back.
Wow. Yes. Did you ever file a complaint with the department?
Yeah, we did, but they just got, I don't know.
Yeah.
We didn't follow up with it because we figured it's just normal practice, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Charles, thanks for sharing that story. See, these are the kind of stories that, you know, white people don't have to worry about this stuff. And white people don't have these kind of stories. And it's just, you know, I have a feeling it's a very, well, Charles, thank you for the call. Brenda in Minneapolis, listening to KTNF. We got a minute, Brenda. A quick one.
I'd like to say that I've been listening to our local progressive radio station quite a bit lately.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been discussing Ferguson. And quite a few people have been calling in saying they don't understand how liberals feel about what occurred there. And they say things like, liberals seem to think the police officer went to work that day thinking, I want to kill a black man. which I've heard no one say, by the way.
Right.
And I feel like they are projecting and that the situation is quite the opposite. And they seem to be quick to believe that Mike Brown was looking to confront an armed police officer and get into a physical altercation with him and to try to take his gun. And they seem to be quick to think that the African-American witnesses are lying. And they can't comprehend the idea that the white police officer is a human being capable of making a mistake and possibly lying, even though he hasn't completed a police report about the incident, and there's been no proof that he was assaulted.
Yeah, excellent point, Brenda. Excellent point. And had it been a white guy who was killed with a half a dozen white witnesses, this would be playing out very differently, and we all know it. It's just nobody wants to acknowledge it. Brenda, thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Check out the Huey P. Newton Gun Club. Thumbs up. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I just got a copy. Actually, I just got a box of copies of a new book called The American Revolution of 1800, the subtitle, How Jefferson Rescued Democracy from Tyranny and Faction and What This Means Today. It's by Dan Sisson with Tom Hartman. And I don't know if, you know, Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Powell's and whatnot, the other online sellers, have books in stock yet to ship. I'm guessing it'll probably take another week or so. But it looks great. And I think the official release date is September 15, but usually books are available a few weeks earlier. So just a heads up. And greetings to the folks in the chat room. I finally made it in. And in the, by the way, in the next hour, I want to talk about fundamentalism and females. There's a really interesting article in Le Monde, the French newspaper. And I want to share a piece of that and add some commentary to it in our third hour. But that said, John, in Cayucos, California, am I saying it right, John?
Yes, you are, Tom.
Hey, you're on the air.
How you doing?
Good.
Hey, I just wanted to recommend, actually, when I was on hold, I thought of a second movie. The movie was White Man's Burden with John Travolta, where society is basically reversed, where the African-Americans have control of the power and the institutions and all that.
Hmm.
And the and he's just a regular worker. He winds up, he delivers a package to his boss at house, and he was like walking on the front lawn. He accidentally saw the boss's wife half clothed, and he ultimately got fired for that, and it ruined his life. He was living in a small, like, house you would see in South Central, you know, with no air conditioning. It's super hot and everything. And not to get into all the details, but everything's reversed, and disaster happens at the end.
Hmm.
But the second movie is a much older movie. I can't remember any of the actors. I think it was in the 60s, and it was called The Watermelon Man. And it was about this white racist guy that just treated everybody like dirt. And one day he wakes up and he's black. And then he realizes the bus won't stop for him to get to work. He doesn't have a job anymore. And it's a really interesting perspective to see if things were reversed, how white men like you and me would be able to handle it.
Yeah.
You know? And I don't think we would do very well. I really don't.
Well, I don't think anybody, I'm frankly very impressed by how a lot of African-Americans have handled it, but nobody should have to.
No,
excellent point.
Like that.
The third one I would add to that, which is, I had spent most of my life hearing about it, but I didn't see it until about 6 years ago. Somebody called into the program and just, you know, really, really, really said, you got to watch this. And I didn't understand the modern revival of the Ku Klux Klan in the United States. But back in the 19-teens, I think, 1915 or thereabouts, Birth of a Nation was the first feature-length movie made in the United States. W.D. Griffiths, I think, was the movie maker. And it's the story of Reconstruction told through the eyes of basically the Klan, white races. And it became the major recruiting vehicle for the Ku Klux Klan through the 19-teens and 1920s. It's a silent movie, and it tells a story that is sort of half true and half not about Reconstruction in North Carolina. And it's, if you want to understand how Jim Crow came about and how white people were reacting in the South to the possibility that black people might be able to vote or run for public office, watch Birth of a Nation. I'm sure it's available, you know, all kinds of places, very easy.
Yeah, sounds very interesting.
But it's long. It's like an hour and a half, 2 hours, but it's an amazing, amazing documentary. Or not documentary. It's propaganda.
Can I bring up one more quick point?
Sure.
I grew up in like the mid Wilshire district, kind of near the La Brea Tar Pits there in LA. And I live between Wilshire and Olympic, and there's only two other streets between that, 8th Street and 9th Street.
I know the area.
North of Wilshire is total white, rich Hancock Park.
Right.
Everything south of Olympic is mostly black. Right. And then there, where I lived, was kind of a little bit of a mix. But we would never, during certain times, walk across Olympic. And then if we got caught north of Wilshire during certain times, the Pinkerton security crew would come out and say, "What are you doing here? We know you don't live on, you know, we know you don't live in this neighborhood."
Right.
And so I was kind of like stuck in the middle.
So it's like there's three levels. There's black, and then there's middle class white, and then there's upper class white.
With less than a mile of separation between all of it.
Yeah, amazing, amazing. John, thanks for sharing with us. I appreciate the call. Charles in Detroit. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you today?
I'm well, thank you. Thanks for asking. I hope you are, too.
Hey, this is the highlight of my day to actually speak to Tom Hartman.
Thank you, Charles. What's on your mind? It says here you're a former police officer.
Yeah, I am. I'm a retired police officer in Detroit. And, you know, initially when I called in, I wanted to speak about the over-militarization of police departments, my former police department included. But, you know, since I've been at home, man, I've heard so many different topics, and I'm like, there's so many different opinions that I have that I'd like to weigh in on if I can have a chance. But
please.
One of the biggest problems I have with police departments right now is that they are being overly militarized. You have people, I mean, it's downright scary, the mentality of some of the people that work the streets now. You know, and there is no atmosphere or there's no appetite for helping anyone. You know, there's no appetite for that. It's like, all I want to do is put somebody in jail, and that's it.
Right. There's no more serve and protect. We're under siege.
Not at all. And when I worked the streets, I hated police work. By the time I left it, I was like, I don't ever want to do anything related to that again.
Why did you hate it?
Well, you know, it was just a dogma of police work, and also, you know, just kind of looking at the people who ascended to leadership positions, and you know, leadership and maturity leadership and immaturity are not mutually exclusive.
Right.
You know, you had people who were like, as human beings, they were nowhere near equipped to be in the positions they were in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, and I just looked at the incompetence on the level of just being human beings that I had a problem with. So I kind of withdrew, and you know, and I thought I hated police work until I sat down with a really decent man and, you know, a very wise man, and he kind of talked me through a few things. And he told me, he said, you know, I don't care if you are, he said, you know what, you could go to med school right now and become a doctor, and people will always say that that's Chuck. He's a cop that's a doctor now, you know. And I realized that, law enforcement is a very noble position. It's very noble. And a lot of people do not treat it with the respect. And, you know, there were many people who thought that I didn't. But I kind of withdrew because I saw things that I didn't, I was not really comfortable with, and I didn't approve. So instead of just being a part of the problem, I just disengaged, which was wrong. And I think looking back on it, I feel like that was like a bit of cowardice on my part because, you know, the thing is you don't want to make any waves, you just get along. But, you know, sometimes it's best to make waves. You know, you have to deal with the consequences that come with it, you know, and, you know, because you're always going to be a human being, so you need to be comfortable with being a human being.
Yeah.
But I looked at things that garnered the praise of people, and I was like, wow, you know, like, and if there are any young police officers listening right now, the thing is, you know, if you are outside the bounds of the law. And you're doing things and your boss is all happy because you're generating all of those statistics. Let me tell you something. It's just like a game of musical chairs. Let the music stop and you don't have a place to sit down. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's it. Because what will happen is, and a lot of these bosses, they go out here, these guys are getting all these statistics. And they go into these CompStat meetings and all this other stuff. And it's like, oh, wow, you're making a difference over there because you got the numbers.
Right.
But the thing is, oftentimes, these young officers are doing things that are highly illegal, you know, against the civil rights violations and things of that nature.
Right.
And as soon as they get caught, you know, they'll go to that same boss who was like, oh, this guy's a great worker. And he'll ask, well, is this the way is this the way you tell them to go? No, no. And they're going to deny it. No, right. no, not at all.
Right.
He did that on his own. So I've dealt with people who have said things like, oh, the bosses don't stand up for you. They don't stand up for you. And I say, well, you didn't really allow them. You know, I mean, there was no way that anybody could have looked out for you on that because what you did was so egregious.
Yeah, I got it. Charles, we're out of time, but thanks for sharing your story with us. And it's great to hear from you. Thank you very much for listening to SiriusXM Radio. We'll be right back. It's 15 minutes before you go.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And be sure to check out GreenWorldRising.org for our new video about carbon. And welcome back. Willis in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. You are on the air. Willis, what's up? Willis? Oh, Willis just hung up. Let's see. Patricia, watching Free Speech TV in Winchester, California, on the DirecTV system. Hey, Patricia, what's on your mind today?
Well, you know, I want to say you are right on target about the white privilege. And I'm so glad that you brought it up because I think it's very important. I do believe that most of white Americans know that. They know they have white privilege, and that's why they do what they do. There was a documentary called White Like Me. I think the person was, name is Ken. I can't remember, but it was excellent, and I wish someone would pull it up and look at it. Also, my other point is that you have a lot of white ministers that preach about God and the children, you know, abortion rights and not to kill the babies. But yet when you see a young black man, and he's a kid as well, 18, that's a kid being killed, there's nothing said.
Mm.
That's that white privilege again. And then you have a Tea Party person like Ted Cruz, whose father preaches hate against President Obama, who's from Cuba himself, Ted Cruz's father, who teaches hate and uses God in that. And then you have the young white kids and white America in general, like black people. They're smart. They got the swag. They got this. Oh, I want to do all these things. The women got the hips. The boobs, whatever. But then they want to be us, but then they don't want to be us. And it's just sad. It's really sad. And we need to learn our history, not just white history. We need to go back to civil rights and look how those people in Alabama, what they had to go through as human beings. No one is better than the next. We all bleed. Our blood is red, and we need to stop. And I'm so sick and tired of it. And those people like Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity, the crazy guy on the radio I can't think of, Rush Limbaugh, they all are very racist people. It's sad that they put it out there. They know in their heart that that young man was murdered. White Americans know it. But they
Patricia,
want to protect that white officer. And it's sad.
Patricia, do you think that most African Americans believe that most white people understand white privilege?
Oh, yes. Yes, I do.
Let me tell you, as a white guy, I don't believe that to be the case. I think that the vast majority of white people do not understand white privilege. I try and talk to white people about white privilege, and they're like, what are you talking about? But it doesn't surprise me that African Americans who understand it would assume that white people know about it.
Well, then, you know, I really can't think of the guy who did the documentary. It was about himself growing up.
Yeah.
But it's called White Like Me. I saw it on television.
Yeah.
And it's about him growing up, and it was about how his parents didn't teach hate. And
right.
He went to a diverse school. His best friend was black. And then he got older, and he saw the privilege, which you're discussing.
Right.
Yeah.
We
got
to figure out a way to teach white people about this, about white privilege. I'm convinced of it. Patricia, thank you very much for the call. Very nice to hear from you. We'll be right back. Before the hour, let's check in with Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com and Free-Don.org. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
Great to see you today. So what's going on in the world?
Well, the Obama administration will unveil a plan today to protect access to copay-free birth control for women in response to the Supreme Court's Hobby Lobby ruling.
Really?
Yes.
So the Obama administration's rolling out a plan so that women who work for companies like Hobby Lobby, mm-hmm. which refuses to pay for insurance that covers birth control, can still get their birth control covered. How do they do that?
Well, what they're going to try and do is to let them obtain birth control directly from their insurer at no extra cost if their boss opts out of covering the service in the company's insurance plan for religious reasons.
So the government picks up the extra cost?
I guess so. I mean, it basically extends the accommodation that already exists for nonprofit organizations.
Right.
So the religious owners can pass the cost onto the insurer, so they're no longer complicit in what they view as a sin, effectively.
Right.
And they're also going to announce an interim rule tweaking the nonprofit accommodation in an end to another lawsuit that's going on. So instead of informing the insurer or third party administrator directly, the new rule says an objecting employer will have to notify the government, which will inform the insurer. And the idea is that the existing plan was objected to by some entities like Wheaton College, who sued, said that it violates their religious belief because it amounts to a permission slip for contraception. The theory is that under the new rule, it will be the government that triggers the provision of birth control and not the employer.
Hmm.
They hope that's going to work.
Remarkable. Okay. Well, we'll see how that plays out. That should produce some interesting furor over on Fox so-called news. What else?
I think it will produce furor.
Yes. What else is going on?
NATO officials said today that the Russian military has moved artillery units manned by Russian personnel inside Ukrainian territory in recent days and is using them to fire at Ukrainian forces. This is the first time that NATO has said it had evidence of the direct involvement of the Russian military inside Ukraine.
Wow. This is scary. This is not good. We'll see how this plays out.
Yeah, we will. Also, Petro Poroshenko, the Russian president, and the U.S. are condemning the movement of a Russian humanitarian convoy, or what NATO Secretary General is calling a so-called humanitarian convoy, into Ukrainian territory without the consent of the Ukrainian authorities and without any involvement of the International Committee of the Red Cross. About 100 trucks.
No, the Red Cross did check the trucks as they went through the border crossing.
Right, but they're not escorting them, and
they're not escorting them, but they did check them and assert that they did not contain military equipment.
Right, but they're condemning it, and the U.S. has condemned it strongly and called on the Russians to immediately remove the convoy.
Yeah. One of the there's an interesting piece in the New York Times about this. One of the thoughts, the Ukrainian 4th of July is coming up at the end of this week. I think it's Sunday. And they're pushing really hard to take these two cities, Donetsk and I forget the name of the other one.
Luhansk.
And they're pushing really hard to take these two cities by Sunday. And apparently Russia doesn't want them to. And the theory is, from the tacticians who are looking at this from the outside, is that if a bunch of these white trucks carrying humanitarian supplies are scattered throughout these cities, which are being bombed from the air by the Ukrainian Air Force right now, that they'll be less likely to bomb the cities, and it will give the rebels a chance to dig in and make it harder for the Ukraine to seize these cities before Sunday. And it's a whole interesting kind of, it's like playing Risk, it's a chessboard thing.
Yeah, it is like playing Risk. It's a very risky game of Risk, too.
It is.
The parents of slain journalist James Foley today urged the international community to help the other hostages held by ISIS. Don and Diane Foley appeared on two morning news TV shows. Diane Foley said, "We do pray, we beg the international community to help the remaining hostages." And it's not clear exactly what she's saying that she wants them to do, to me, from the quotations that I'm seeing. They said they're planning to establish a foundation in Jim's name. When they were asked about whether they thought the U.S. and other governments should pay ransom to terrorist groups for the release of hostages, John Foley called it a difficult issue, but didn't comment on Jim's case or future situations.
Right. Yeah, there are those who suggest that the fact that European governments have given millions, perhaps hundreds of millions of dollars to ransom out their citizens from ISIS is one of the reasons why ISIS is, still doing this, and that it increases the risk of any American anywhere in the world being captured by these guys and held for ransom. It's a business now. And that by paying the ransoms, we help put that business into action. I saw that when I was down in Bogota back a little more than a decade ago, where if you were an American and you were walking around in Bogota, or the citizen of any other country, where you might have a rich family, they didn't go through governments, they went through families, you were at very high risk of being kidnapped. And I met somebody who had been kidnapped and then, bought out. And in fact, she'd been kidnapped, and her husband bought her out. And it's bad business.
Yeah.
Bad business. On the other hand, if you're the parent of somebody, what do you do? Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking to you. Have a very great weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye. We'll be back with more of Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Harbert Show.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back to the Tom Hartmann Program. We've been talking about white privilege. I'd like to talk about male privilege. There's an interesting article by Guy Sorman in the French newspaper Le Monde that was forwarded along to me by a listener and translated by his wife, Raquel. And I don't know if they want their last name used on the air, so I won't. But I also did a Google translation, looked up the article and did a Google translation on it, and it's a pretty clean translation. And I think Guy gets started in the right place. I would like to take it a step beyond where he's going with it, but let me just share with you what Guy Sorman wrote in Le Monde. About, he said, the headline is the main common threat among radical Muslim movements is women. And he asked the question, what is the link among Muslim movements as different as Hamas, Al-Qaeda, Hezbollah, Boko Haram, the Taliban, and ISIS? What do these groups have in common? He says, all claim to be based on the Quran, but actually they have different interpretations. Which is correct. And in fact, some of them are Shia, some are Sunni, some are, whatever. He says they're all embedded in different cultures. Correct. So what is it that's in common among them? He says, however, there's a link that unites them, which has less to do with religion or ideology and more of what one can call group psychoanalysis, hatred of women, misogyny. Now, I would add to this, see, he's looking at the Muslim movements, the fundamentalist Muslims. I would add to this the fundamentalist Christians. You've got fundamentalist Christians who want to restrict a woman's right to choose to have an abortion, who want who are fighting against equal pay laws for women, who basically are asserting that women should be silent. That they should be, forced motherhood, forced pregnancy. So I would say this is not just radical Islam, it's radical religion. He says, we do not find the source of this hatred of women and their bodies in the Quran. The Prophet Muhammad did not treat women with violence nor with contempt. And his spouse, Khadija, was at his side and took part in his conquests and his revelations. Something I did not know. Guy Sorman goes on to say, it is true that in the West, there's always been discrimination against women, less in recent times, but they were not exterminated as they are today in Allah's name, as in Nigeria and Mount Sinjar in Iraq. We may read and reread the Quran, but we will not find the source of this hatred in it. And then he gets into Saeed Qutb. Saeed Qutb died in 1966 at the hands of Nasser, as I recall. Yeah, in fact, President Gamal Abdel Nasser pushed Islamists toward violence. Qutb, there's Adam Curtis, the British documentary filmmaker, makes films for BBC, put together a video, and I think this one is called The Power of Nightmares. There's a couple of them that he did that are just absolutely extraordinary. But he did one, and you can find it on YouTube and in other places around the internet. This three-hour series, as I recall, documentary about the origin of the Muslim Brotherhood, and at the same time the origin of the neoconservative movement in the United States, and how this guy Qutb, Sayyid Qutb, 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 came to the United States. He was in New York in 1949. And then he moved to St. Louis, as I recall, and got his degree and then went back to Egypt. And he was horrified by what he saw here in the United States. He apparently had a bad romantic encounter in New York and decided women are awful. And then he went to St. Louis and he saw, you know, middle class households and green lawns. I mean, he actually went on a tirade about lawns, so, you know, wasted space and all this kind of stuff. But basically, it was the decadence of the West that horrified him. And he went back to Egypt and founded the Muslim Brotherhood. And a lot of these groups came out of this. But the point is that most of these hyper-fundamentalist groups are not just about their religion. And in some cases, kill the infidel or, you know, kill those who won't convert and all that kind of thing. They're not just about their religion. They are also about oppressing women. And to the extent that the Judeo-Christian ethic has informed the United States and the creation of the United States and the laws of the United States over all these years, I would submit to you that that has, in some very, very significant ways, influenced the state of affairs, as it were, with regard to women in the United States and women around the world. There's a piece that I had. I don't think I closed it. Maybe I did. Well, there was a really interesting article titled "The Things That Women Couldn't Do in the 1960s," and I thought I had this up on my screen. And I don't. But, you know, the women in the United States were lacking rights. In many cases, well, I'll have to find it during the break and bring it back to you. But, you know, I wrote about this in Unequal Protection about the situation with women in the United States. Up until fairly recently, this is something that is like ancient male privilege, as it were. And women, hang on just a second here. Here we go. 51 to 53. Got to look at my own book. At the time of the formation of the United States, and for the next basically 150 years. A married woman was not allowed to make out a will because, I'm quoting myself here, this is my book on equal protection, which you can find for free online over at truthout.org and, of course, from any bookstore. A married woman was not legally allowed to make out a will because she was not legally allowed to own land or control anything else worthy of willing to another person. Any property a woman brought into the marriage became her husband's at the moment of marriage and would revert to her only if he died and she did not remarry. But even then, she would get only one third of her husband's property, and what third that was and how she could use it were determined by a male court-appointed executor who would supervise her for the rest of her life or until she remarried, in which case she was handed off to another male. When a widow died, the executor would either take the property for himself or decide to whom it could pass. A woman had no say in the matter because she had no right to sign a will. She could not sue in a court of law except under the same weak procedures allowed for the mentally ill and children supervised by men. If the man of a family household died, the executor would decide who would raise the wife's children and in what religion. She had no right to make those decisions. If she was poor, it was a virtual certainty that her children would be taken from her. It was impossible in the United States of America for a married woman to have any legal responsibility for her children, control of her own property, buy or sell land, or even obtain an ordinary license. So we have white privilege, and then we have male privilege, and then we have white male privilege. And you add it all together, and it's really ugly.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And in other cultures, it's male privilege of whoever is the ruling group, in many cases not white, as in the case of Boko Haram. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. There are, by the way, there are people looking at this Ferguson tape, this Michael Brown tape, and some are suggesting that it shows that he actually paid for the cigars, didn't have enough money to pay for as many as he wanted, took some of them back and put them on the counter. We don't know what the words were or why he interacted with the shopkeeper, but it was not the store who called in the complaint about shoplifting. It was a customer. And it was not the store who provided the tape to the media. The police department went and took it from the store, and they provided it to the media. So some very, very interesting stuff going on here. So anyway, back to the phone lines here. Mike in Hopkinsville, Kentucky. Hey, Mike.
Yes, sir. 2 points I want to make. First, on the white privilege thing, I cannot tell you how many people I've made their jaws drop when they're having a discussion, and I will say, well, here's the history of North America. When white men got here, there wasn't a black person to be found, and there was Indians as far as you could see. My second point is this ice bucket drop for ALS.
Yeah.
Okay, first, my father-in-law, he died from ALS about 2 years ago.
Yeah, it's also called Lou Gehrig's disease, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
It was a very sad situation.
Yeah.
But it drives me up a wall watching this ice bucket challenge, watching all these people in Africa who can't have water, and all of these fires over in the West going out of control, and people are just haphazardly, even though the cause is good, just dumping water on the ground.
Well, come on, Mike. If you live in an area where water is abundant, and if you don't pour it on your head, you're not going to put it in a box and ship it UPS to California.
Well, yeah, but it's the actual act of it that makes no sense to me.
Yeah, this reminds me of when my mother used to say, you know, eat your liver. There's children starving in China. And it's like, fine, let's put it in a box and send it to them. And, at that point, she stopped saying that. I don't know.
Would it not make more sense just to send the money?
Well, it would. But, drama catches people's attention. And this is frankly.
I think it's very self-serving on a lot of people.
Well, yeah. If they were pouring something that had considerable value, and I realize there are parts of the world where water does have considerable value, parts of America increasingly where water has considerable value, but a bucket of ice water, I'm going to cut people some slack for that, and I would think particularly if your dad died of ALS that you would too. I mean, the ALS Association has raised over $20 million in the last since July 9th. Whereas a year ago, when they did a similar fundraiser, but it didn't have the ice buckets, they'd only raised $1.9 million. So,
well, I have to agree with you on that point, that it is raising money for a very good cause. But one other point I want to make real quick is I used to be a Fox devotee. But since I've discovered your show about 8 months ago, I really have a lot of respect for you.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
And I appreciate what you do.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks for your kind words. I appreciate it. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We will be right back. It is 20 minutes past the hour. Okay, damn. Coach Glenn in State College, Pennsylvania. Hey, Glenn, how you doing?
Hi, Tom.
Nice to hear your voice.
Nice to hear you, too. Our friend, whose name I won't mention, a coach friend of ours' son, had mental issues, was thrown out of the mental hospital without his medication. The doctor wouldn't see him for a couple of weeks. He went to a restaurant telling people he was going to commit suicide with a gun in his belt. Five cops had him down on his stomach. No, and two of them knew he had mental issues, and one stood up, shot him twice through the kidneys, and killed him. And he's white.
Wow.
It just, you know, I don't understand that.
Well, mentally ill people are viewed as less than human by much of the power structure of the United States. And, you know, I'd say it's a separate issue, but it's part of a larger issue of we need to acknowledge the humanity of everybody. We just absolutely need to acknowledge the humanity of everybody. Glenn, thanks for the call. Damien in Manorville, New York. Hey, Damien.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
I just have I've been listening to a lot of what you've been saying. I've been listening to a lot of what you're saying, and one of the things is that you guys aren't covering everything. There was three black men in Ferguson who robbed a white hot dog vendor's phone and struck him with a hammer. And nobody's saying anything about this guy. This guy has a metal plate in his head. Nobody's saying anything about that. Nobody's
Damien, I got to say, I'm sorry. I don't know what you're talking about, so I can't speak to it. Jay in Seattle. Hey, Jay, what's up?
Hi. I just want to provide a different perspective. I'm a black guy, and I've been listening to the caller, so a lot of what I want to say has changed, but, you know, I'll try to work through it. I'll start with giving an example of the effects of white privilege on someone who's black, and I'll pose a question to you in terms of if white people know or don't know or what have you, if they're familiar with white privilege. I would agree with you that most are not, but I'd also say that part of the reason why they wouldn't be familiar or necessarily embrace the notion is because, you know, in our country, no one wants to be found as to having any type of advantage. We're in a country where everybody works hard for what they get, and, you know, no one really wants to acknowledge how much we're helped, or very few people want to acknowledge how much we're helped by others. Or even when you look at people who, you know, have wealth passed down, they a lot of times want to walk away from that. They don't want people to know that. They sort of want to be known as, you know, accomplishing everything on their own.
Right.
And so if you are a white person, and, you know, it's difficult being an African-American professional because, of course, we're expected to call in and complain about, you know, these anecdotal episodes of police brutality or any other example of where white privilege hinders us, right? And so when you are white, you're expecting this coming from a black person. And one of my questions to you is, I mean, I know you're completely enlightened, but if you aren't as liberal or as enlightened, and someone who is black comes to you talking about white privilege, don't you think that they're far less likely to be open-minded to something like that versus someone like you coming to them and maybe explaining the whole, you know, notion of white privilege and what that means?
I'm not sure I understand your question, Jay.
Okay, you approaching another white person and
right.
explaining to them what white privilege is, don't you think they would be more open-minded and
oh,
more receptive
yeah.
to listening?
They'll listen to me instead of to
black?
You.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, of course.
That's one of the frustrating things.
And that's white privilege, too.
Right, exactly. And so I'll give an example of how white privilege affects me. Anytime you're a black professional, the overwhelming majority of the time, you're going to be one of very, very, very few blacks in any business environment you're in or anything of that nature.
Right.
And so one of the things you find yourself doing is legitimizing yourself a lot. People ask you what you do when you make purchases. People ask you what school you went to frequently when you're in a decision-making position. And so you find yourself time and time and time again. You know, and they're very nice about it. It's just that, you know, I'm an optimist, and a lot of times I want to believe that it's anything but white privilege, but it's very hard when I ask my white counterparts, hey, did this person ask you what you do for a living?
Mm.
It just feels invasive, and it feels inappropriate, and it feels as if I answer it in a way that is impressive, then I'm legitimized.
So when someone asks you what you do for a living, the subtext to that question is, are you part of our class? Are you as good as, that's a very crude way to say it, a clumsy way to say it, but
right.
Are you as good as the rest of us? That's the subtext of the question. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes. And it, the reason why, and again, this is a little subtle form of it, because what happens is I have to explain my whole journey. Because
yeah.
In this situation, it's so rare to see someone like myself in this situation. And again, this is so thing. It's not something, you know, that I necessarily get upset about. I'm just bringing it up as an example. Anytime, and again, the roles to be reversed, anytime a minority is put in a situation like this, on a certain level, they're going to have to legitimize themselves.
Yeah. And let me add to that, Jay, if I may. Ask your mother or your wife or your sister about stories that are very, that are very similar, where women are basically, you know, disrespected and not regarded as equal, and they have to say, no, this is what I do, that kind of thing. So there is like levels of this stuff. But yeah, excellent point, Jay. You said it very well. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. And thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio there in Seattle. We'll be back. It's 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So if you are female and you have thoughts on male privilege, I'd like to hear from you, too. Okay, here we go. This is CNN published this on August 12th. Five things women couldn't do in the 1960s. Women could not get a credit card in the 1960s. Banks could refuse to issue a credit card to an unmarried woman, and if she was married, her husband was required to co-sign. As recently as the 1970s, credit cards in many cases were issued with only a husband's signature. It was not until the Equal Credit Opportunity Act of 1974 that it became illegal to refuse a credit card to a woman based on her gender. In the 1960s, a woman could not serve on a jury. It varied by state, but the main reason women were kept out of jury pools was that they were considered to be the center of their home, which was their primary responsibility as caregivers. In 1961, the Supreme Court unanimously upheld a Florida law that exempted women from serving on juries. It wasn't until 1973 that women could serve on juries in all 50 states. In the 1960s, women couldn't go on the birth control pill. Issues like reproductive freedom and a woman's right to decide when and whether and when to have children. This is from Katie McLaughlin writing for CNN, August 12th, 2014. She says, issues like reproductive freedom and a woman's right to decide when and whether to have children were only just beginning to be openly discussed in the 1960s. In 1957, the FDA approved the birth control pill, but only for, quote, severe menstrual distress, end quote. It wasn't until 1960 it was approved as a contraceptive, and even at that, it was illegal in some states and could be prescribed only to married women for purposes of family planning, and not all pharmacies stocked it. A woman in the 1960s could not get an Ivy League education. Yale and Princeton did not accept female students until 1969. Harvard didn't accept women until 1977, when it merged with all-female Radcliffe College. Cornell admitted the first, well, that was back in 1870. They were, with the exception of Cornell and the University of Pennsylvania, women could not attend an Ivy League school until 1969 at the earliest. Brown, Dartmouth, and Columbia did not offer admission to women until 1971, 72, and 1981, respectively. And women could not experience equality in the workplace in the 1960s. Kennedy's Commission on the Status of Women produced a report in 1963, they revealed, among other things, that women earned 59 cents for every dollar that men earned and were kept out of the more lucrative professional positions. Again, quoting CNN here. That all ended with Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. Oh, and bonus, Katie McLaughlin notes, women couldn't openly talk about sex. Helen Gurley Brown, Sex and the Single Girl, is incredibly, and Betty Friedan, The Feminine Mystique, incredibly controversial books back in the 60s. So that's all that. Pat in Beloit, Wisconsin. Hey, Pat, what's up?
You know, speaking of women, PBS had a great special about a year ago about women in America and their progress over the decades. And it was, I would recommend, I think it's called Made in America.
Okay.
But when I entered college in the 60s, they asked me, was I going to become a teacher or a nurse?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah,
there were no other options.
Right, and there were home ec courses offered not only in high school but in college, and they were entirely female.
Yes, and it's when I bought my first car after my husband had passed away. He died quite young. They didn't really want to negotiate with me till I brought my grown son in with me, and then they were willing to talk to him more than I.
Right.
It was really quite embarrassing for the gentleman, as far as I was concerned, because I was an independent woman. The reason I called, though, is because I am an educator, as it turns out. And about 20 years ago, we had an in-service that kind of opened my eyes to discrimination. We're a very multicultural school district, and they brought in a gentleman from what they call the Johnson Institute, and he talked about the fact that every morning when you, and most of us were white in the audience, wake up, you never think of the color of your skin. But he said he, as an African-American and every other African-American, when they wake up, they say, I am a black American. And it just has always stuck in my mind that's right. I never think of the color of my skin. And African-Americans, anyone with brown skin, has to always keep that in mind. And it certainly made me have a different perspective on the race issue.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And that's an excellent, excellent way of saying it. Thank you, Pat. Thank you for that. Dave in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Dave.
Hi. Yeah, I want to address this issue of white privilege.
Yeah.
And I think one of the reasons why whites have a problem with it is that they're not in a situation where they're faced with recognizing it.
And they're not asking for it.
Exactly. I mean, I'm originally from Pennsylvania, and I moved to Nashville. And I came from a predominantly white area where it just simply wasn't something you thought about. And it wasn't until I moved to the South where I could see things like institutional racism in practice that you know, it sort of was a slap in the face, and you go, oh, I get it now. I can see, right. I can see why this is. And for me, where it really was obvious and where it really came to me is my wife and I for a while were going out on Friday nights to high school football games. You know, it's a cheap form of entertainment. You get to see the kids play. It's fun. And you know, I started going to these games where it would be predominantly white schools against predominantly black schools. And there were some, you know, glaring obvious differences. Like, for example, the band for the white school would come out. They'd have full uniforms. They'd have nice instruments. And then you look at the black school, the predominantly black school, and a lot of times they would come out on the field with a uniform that consisted of nothing but jeans and matching T-shirts. And you see something like that, and you go, wow, there's something really wrong here.
Yeah, yeah. And what's really wrong with that is that we fund education principally with property taxes. And as recently as the 1970s, we had legal redlining. We had banks and communities and covenants legally keeping people of color out of neighborhoods or locking them into neighborhoods more commonly, frankly. And mm-hmm. and then you fund the schools with the property taxes and you know, surprise, surprise, the people who are being economically oppressed don't have the money to pay the property taxes, so they have a crappy school, and so their kids don't get a good education. And then, you know, people like Bill O'Reilly sit around and go, why aren't these kids, why don't they just get a job? Well, you know, exactly. they don't have an education that prepared them for a job. Why don't they have an education that prepared them for a job? Because in their, you know, just 20 years ago, you know, in their parents' generation, their parents were locked into this very, very poor area, and their parents didn't get an education. It's just, you know, we've got to do something about this. Dave, thank you very much. Well said. Valerie in San Diego. Hey, Valerie, what's up?
Hi. I'd like to bring up the insidious aspect to the misogyny of women. More and more, I'm starting to recognize that people are using us as insults, like you throw like a girl, you run like a girl, or they use our body parts as insults.
Right. You're absolutely right, and particularly as insults used against men. But yeah.
Yes, mostly. Yeah, well, and it came up because this little, what is she, 12-year-old little leaguer?
Mm-hmm.
Who can throw a 70-mile-an-hour
fastball?
Oh, my gosh. And somebody said, well, I guess that gives up that notion of throwing like a girl.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Valerie, thank you. Excellent examples. Susan in Albuquerque, listening on KABQ. Hey, Susan.
Hi. I'm a longtime listener and a first-time caller. I'm very excited to be talking to you. So just for the record, I'm a white woman. I'm almost 40 years old, and I first learned about white privilege about 20 years ago in college. I'm a former teacher, and I'm currently a school counselor. My concern is that on social media outlets such as Facebook, it's been very disheartening to see the lack of interest through, you know, either likes or comments on posts that I've posted about Michael Brown's killing, white privilege, and racism in America. And
is this because the majority of your peers, family, friend are white?
I believe they are. Yes, the majority of them are family, friend, or white. I have several black friends who are commenting and posting, and I have maybe two or three white friends who are commenting and posting. Just last weekend, I posted a picture of my husband and I on vacation, and almost within 2 days, I had 57 likes on that.
Right.
Any of these other things that I've posted, maybe 1, 2, 3 likes. And so one of the movements that I've been highly involved in has been the Gay Straight Ally campaign. I'm not gay, but I am a straight ally. And one idea that just keeps going through my mind is I wish that we had some kind of campaign, but you know what? I'm a white ally. And we need to educate ourselves. We need to talk about this. We need to not be afraid. I think that, you know, most of my friends who are not commenting on this and not posting on this is because they're afraid. They're afraid that they're going to say the wrong thing.
Yeah.
And I think that we need to be okay with saying the wrong thing.
I think there are some people who are afraid of it. There are some people who just don't get it. And then there's a small subcategory, and I think you find most of them in right-wing media and on right-wing websites, who actually understand white privilege and want to keep it, right? They just want to say, this is ours. We're going to keep this thing. Susan, excellent points. And the same with male privilege. Thank you very much for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your thoughts on my thoughts on this stuff right after this. Oh, check out GreenWorldRising.org, please. Welcome back. Ken in Ticonderoga, New York, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite system. Hey, Ken, what's up?
White power. That's what's up. We're the same age, Tom. 1951, mm-hmm. B-63 in September. Served in Vietnam aboard helicopter carrier, Gulf of Tonkin. 1972, we had massive race riots shipboard, so bad that three dead, dozens injured. They pulled the entire float, 2,000 Marines, 700 sailors off the line, back to the Republic of the Philippines, back to Subic.
Wow.
Bring in race relations counselors to sort it out. Out of that, I wound up getting elected as a chair for an alternative grievance channel.
Mm-hmm.
And in the junior enlisted member of a three-man race relations team where we took division by division on ship and sat people down across a boardroom table and got them talking. Now, in essence, that's the only way to fix things is to get people face-to-face in a non-hostile environment where you can control the conversation and get people to talk. Mm-hmm. At the very same time that we were doing that, the captain, the executive officer, who was basically the sheriff on board, my division officer and the deck officer, who were all bigoted, racist, biased, some of all of the above, were putting lipstick on it. I still have the commendation from the captain in a scrapbook. You know, great work. We appreciate everything that you're doing to blah, 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 small steps. Exactly. At the same time, he was doing everything he could to undermine what we were doing and carrying on exactly the way they were prior to the riots. And 3 months later, Admiralty Mass, the captain lost his ship, the executive officer, the division officer, and the deck officer all lost, all got busted in rank and got black marked on their page 13s. The bottom line is, and I would have figured, you know, 40 years ago because of, you know, the back end of the draft, the, you know, the unhappiness with war, a lot of different reasons for it exploding when it did on board ship. We're out at sea for 60 days, too, was that stuff was gone. But all you got to do is look at, you know, a 95% plus white police department and a white county prosecutor that's doing everything he can to muddy the water on the investigation in a predominantly black town, and nothing's changed.
Yeah.
That's so disheartening.
Well, and on top of that, the way that Missouri law treats law enforcement officers, I mean, at law, all he has to do is assert that he felt threatened. He doesn't even have to prove that he was threatened. All he has to do is assert it, and he's basically automatically let off the hook for a murder charge. I'm telling you, this Officer Wilson is not going to be prosecuted for this, or at least not successfully prosecuted for this. But, Ken, thanks for sharing the story. That's interesting. I didn't realize that the race riots of the 70s extended to, you know, ships in the Gulf of off the coast of Vietnam. Thank you very much. Good to hear from you, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to everyone at our various syndicating companies, Westwood One, Pacifica Radio, Sirius XM Satellite Radio, Cable Radio Network, Free Speech TV, on Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the others around the country, all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn, to Netroots Radio at netrootsradio.com, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to the folks in the chat room, hey, to Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, Bob Ney, and everyone at Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. Thank you. Robert in New York City. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Yeah, I was just listening to your little rant about white privilege. I have a lot of African friends from Nigeria and Kenya, and they've been here over 20 years, and they became United States citizens. And their biggest thing is, it's like what Henry Ford said, if you think you can, you can. If you don't think you can, you won't.
Yeah, you're describing the immigrant mentality, which transcends race. It's an there's an absolute body of science around that white people who come here, black people who come here, whatever, you name the color, and you can go back, you know, hundreds of years when people are first generation and sometimes second generation, but it tends to fade out by the end of the second generation. First generation immigrants have a different mindset. And it's not just in the United States. It's anywhere in the world. Immigrants tend to be more successful than people who, you know, the indigenous people, the people who's for more than two generations have been born in the country.
Well, I'm third generation Italian, and I'm pretty successful in and of myself, but they're first generation, and they specifically, they're raising their kids with a mindset that, you know what, doesn't matter what other people tell you, it's you have to be successful, and you have to be successful on your own.
Yeah.
And don't rely on other people, just rely on yourself and your family. And that's the mindset that LBJ put in motion that they don't have, our native-born black people. And it's gonna take generations for them to realize that they have to rely on themselves, and they have to.
But you can't rely on yourself, Robert. You can't rely on yourself. You don't educate yourself. You don't build your own streets. You don't build your own neighborhoods. You don't. I mean, this myth of the you know, Davy Crockett is just that. It's a myth.
I'm not saying that they're gonna build their own streets, but you know what? Don't allow them to be on the streets at night. Make sure they're home. Make sure they're studying.
They? Who's this they you're talking about?
They're doing what they need to be successful. Don't empower them not to be successful.
I don't think anybody is suggesting that anybody should be empowered not to be successful, Robert. I realize that that's probably the Rush Limbaugh talking point, but that's definitely not what I'm saying. Jerry in Long Island, New York. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Yeah, how you doing? Yeah, especially against the backdrop of Mike Papantonio yesterday saying that we're creeping into another expanding war in Iraq as we focus and pay attention to other things. Against the backdrop, I like to verbally push back against not anything he said, but against what hawkish conservative Republicans like Congressman Mike Rogers are saying about Iraq and ISIS. For instance, this past Sunday, he was on Face the Nation program again for the umpteenth time, and Mr. Rogers was saying that with respect to Iraq and ISIS, that ISIS is a threat to us and the rest of the West. And then he went on to say that they want to conduct attacks in the West, and we're in greater danger now than
before. No, I'm with you, Jerry. It is a horrible thing to see these war hawks, these neocons coming out and pushing this stuff. Kim in Mooresville, Indiana. Hey, Kim, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It's the male privilege thing. I went all the way through school and through 2 degrees in college, and never once heard Elizabeth Cady Stanton's name mentioned.
Right.
And you were talking earlier about the married women's rights. She was instrumental in getting that passed.
Mm-hmm.
Her father was a judge and a lawyer, and she would listen to the people come into his office. And there was a woman named Flora Campbell that came in, and her husband had died, and her son was mean. Some accounts are stepson, but anyway. Of course, all the property went to him. Well, that was a farm that she owned before the marriage, but that didn't matter. And when Elizabeth heard that, she was really distressed about it. And so she knew that the way for women to get any power was through law and through the vote, especially. And the Women's Rights Convention in Seneca Falls in 1848, she brought up the voting rights aspect. And she was told, you know, her husband left town because he was so embarrassed by it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
She was
brilliant.
But they were a pair.
Yeah.
She
and
a lot of the brain.
Yeah, and her colleague around that time of Susan B. Anthony. Yeah, and in fact Elizabeth Cady Stanton led the charge in 1868 or 1866. Against the 14th Amendment. And the reason why was because the 14th Amendment has the word male 3 times in it. And she said, if you get that word male into the Constitution, it'll take 100 years to get it out. And it was 100 years later, a little more than 100 years later, actually, that the civil rights for women, was passed as law. But excellent point. The history, women's history, is not taught in our schools. So, very good point. Kim, thank you very much for calling and for making it. And the history of Elizabeth Cady Stanton, the history of Susan B. Anthony, who, you know, showed up to vote in, I think it was 1874, showed up to vote, voted, and then got arrested for it. And ended up basically pleading guilty because she didn't have the money to take it to the Supreme Court. I mean, this is mind-boggling stuff. Anyhow, thanks so much for being with us today. It's been a very, very interesting day. A lot going on in the world. We'll pick up where we left off on Monday. In the meantime, don't forget, democracy it doesn't happen all by itself. And you can't trust it to these idiots here in Washington, D.C. You got to get out there and get active. Tag, you're it. We'll see you Monday. Have a good day.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.